Session number 8941, rule number 14.
Major Jefferson, reel 14. I think you wanted to say something about the OP towers in the desert.
Yes, well, watching the television at the weekend in July 1985, it suddenly struck me that I was looking at something that reminded me of the desert. I was watching the Open Championship from St. George's Sandwich, and Sandwich is a course with just very, very undulating, rolling sand dunes, really, with grass on them, but they are basically sand dunes, and they're rolling and they're undulating, and they're sometimes deeper than you expect them to be, and it's extremely difficult to judge distance. And I looked, and there was nothing in the picture for most of the day except a chap and a little flag waving in the distance X hundred yards away, terribly difficult to estimate, and behind it very often the BBC tower, which looked exactly like my OP tower, except that it didn't have a Hessian up it to hide the fact that there was someone there or not. And you had no idea whether it was a 100-foot tower 2,000 yards away or a 50-foot tower a few hundred yards away, because you couldn't see the bottom. And I thought that that would help people who are listening today who weren't in the desert to understand what we were talking about and why people could stand on the top of a tank with a cigarette in their mouth and glasses up to their eyes, observing fire, and not be immediately mown down.
If I might put in a question on that, did you have any scientific instruments with which to try and measure distance?
Up the tower, no, and I regret the fact. Equally, if I were to do it today, I would be much more careful about the way we marked out the bearings. I never quite knew whether the metal of the tower was disrupting my compass bearings or not. And with today's world, with plastic and things like that, it would be much easier to sort that one out.
Was there any instrument like the Barr and Stroud predictor for anti-aircraft guns that you could use to make a...
There was, and indeed, of course, the... although we didn't use them ourselves in the OP time, because we were just up there with our bodies and our binoculars and nothing else much, and a telephone. But it was perfectly possible for the counter-battery people, and they did, to do cross-sections on an artillery board from reports from two towers, because they knew where they were, and if our bearings were any good at all, they could get an intersection quite nicely. And of course we had Barr and Strouds in the gun position for measuring distances, but we never actually had one, at least I never actually had one. I think that I was one of the comparatively few people who used the AP tower regularly. I never had one actually up an AP tower to my memory.
Presumably if you were trying to find bearings, you might have been able to take sightings on celestial bodies at night.
I don't think that that thought crossed our mind. It would have been possible, and indeed, now you suggest it, I'm very ashamed we didn't. But no, we just used our only compass bearings, because we weren't observing over very long distances, of course, and we always had the ridge. I could see one of the 6.3 barrels for the whole 4 months, and I knew exactly where that was. So it's perfectly easy just to sort of stick your arms out and get within 2 or 3 degrees.
You could measure things by how many fingers then?
Oh yes, with the greatest of ease. And when you've been doing it for some time, you do it pretty accurately.
Were the nights clear?
Some nights were very clear. Some nights, the night of June the 30th, was thick fog. That was when we were retreating towards Alamein. Many nights, of course, there was artificial smoke of one sort or another. Tanks milling around, or gunfire, or natural dust. But sometimes you could see, unbelievably far.
And I think you also wanted to say something about the fighting in the Mat Mata Hills.
Yes, I just wanted to make one correction. I've mentioned on the last tape the crossroads that we were going towards as Cairo. It wasn't called Cairo, it was called Hadi, and it was near Halouf, H-A-L-L-O-U-F, because 5th Brigade split as we got into the hills, and the Raj Rif went off towards Cairo, and the Essex went off towards Halouf, and that was where the Italian guns were, under the crest of the hills on the way to Halouf.
What happened to you after the fighting in the Mat Mata Hills? Where did you go next?
After the Mat Mata Hills, we moved down towards... let me get the order right. We went from the Mat Mata Hills to Akarit, didn't we? We took up a position... No, we went from there to Marath, surely. No, we went to the Mat Mata Hills from Marath, that's right. We went from the Mat Mata Hills down to Akarit, and we took up a position facing the hills of the Wadi Akarit, and we occupied those positions by night. And Sod's Law has it, of course, that the 1st Field are on the 4th Indian map, and the 31st Field are on the 4th Indian map, but the 11th Field are not on the 4th Indian map, so I've got to admit myself. And when we'd been there a couple of days, we were pretty much under shell fire on that road where we took up our positions. We had to take them up by night. And indeed, we lost one of our battery commanders there on a mine. He was commander of the 7884 battery, O'Halloran, Dennis O'Halloran. He was killed on a mine because we moved after a couple of nights a little away from the road into safer ground. And then eventually there was a silent attack from the Gurkhas, particularly 1st, 2nd and 1st, 9th, on the hills on the left of the Wadi Akarit, and this was meant to be a silent attack, and 50 Div and 51st Highland Div, 50 Div in the centre and 51st Highland Div on the coastal plain on the Jebel Rumana, were due to make their attack a little later. And this, of course, is where the Gurkhas, where Subadar Lal Bahadur Thapa won his VC for knocking the Germans out above the anti-tank ditch in the hills on the left. And I say it was a silent attack, but at one stage I'm pretty certain it is true that the silent attack was actually led by some of our guns, because we had to move by night forward of the last range of hills onto the forward slopes, in full view pretty well of the hills behind the Wadi Akarit. And indeed, the gunners, most of that day, had a very good view of where their shells were falling. I went again, as usual, with the 1st, 4th Essex, and we spent some time sheltering in the anti-tank ditch. I think I've already mentioned the fact that sitting in that anti-tank ditch, the Italian... They must have been mortar bombs, I think, rather than shells, because they looked just like cricket balls in the sky, large numbers of cricket balls hurtling towards one. And seemingly quite slowly, which makes me think that they must have been mortar bombs rather than artillery shell, although there were some Italian guns higher up the ridge when we got there. But we eventually got to the top of the ridge by nightfall, or just before nightfall. There was a certain amount of mild unpleasantness at the top, and there were 88, apart from machine gun fire and a certain amount of close fighting for the infantry, not for their gunner, there were 88 trained on the top, who made life not particularly happy for a time.
Presumably they were German guns.
Oh, the 88 would be, yes, but it was an Italian held position on the flank. The Germans were facing the 50 Div and 51st Div. Can I tell you that story about 50 Div? Because I think we've spent some time on this question of divisional rivalry, and I've mentioned the fact that although Marath was a 50 Div battle, 4th Indian, as a gunner, I had to go in for a short time in my armoured car and try and give them some additional firepower. And I remember so clearly that as we were being pulled back to do the switch through the Martyr Hills, a New Zealand truck was standing by the side of the road, and a 51st Highland truck went up towards the battle, and the New Zealander shouted out, "You can go up now, 50 Div have been there," from which you'll gather that 51 were still the highway decorators and the newcomers. 50 Div had a hell of a war, and they are, with the New Zealanders, very high in my list of people I admire, apart from the fact that at the Wadi Akarit, I remember now, I had a Geordie Bombardier Sellers in my OP truck, and being a Geordie and a miner, he got, we were now, thank God, out of the real desert, he got observation post down 6 foot in no time at all, a skill that I appreciated greatly. I think that's all for that one.
You were mentioning the mortaring. Were the Italian mortars generally accurate and quick?
This was more like a barrage. This is why I had to ponder to describe them as mortars. It was, in effect, a defensive fire barrage, but they were travelling so slowly at the peak that I think they must have been mortars, or they could have been howitzers at extreme elevation, and just I was catching them at the peak. But I can see them now, just look like a lot of cricket balls in the sky.
You mentioned this business of a silent attack. Could you say what a silent attack is and how you go about doing it?
Well, I mean, it was the Gurkhas who were going to do this, so they did it, and this chap eventually was chasing Germans along the peak. I mean, a silent attack is a noisy attack, meaning it makes any noise. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it's as simple as that. Of course, we had to move forward. We were clanking in front of the infantry marching on tiptoe.
Presumably, then, it's an attack without a preliminary barrage.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes. I mean, later on, there was a formal fire plan, but yes, I'm sorry, I should have realised that.
So the idea is simply to take the enemy by surprise and get either to attack them or to get forward onto a start line without being detected.
Well, in this case, to take the objective, which was the hills on the left of the position, which overlooked the main position where the 50 Div and 51st Highland Div were, and the fact that the Gurks got up there by dawn meant that the enemy didn't have enfilading observation over the whole battlefield, because the main plain was very open ground from the hills on the left. There were hills in front and hills on the left, and they could have enfiladed it very easily if the Gurkhas hadn't taken the high ground on the left of the battlefield.
You mentioned that you were out of the real desert by that stage.
Well, we must have been, because I remember Sellers digging, and we got down some depth, and I was very grateful for the fact that we had got down some depth. Don't ask me whether it was good tilth or not, I don't remember, but I just know, I can remember very clearly being happy that I had a Geordie Bombardier ex-coal miner. And I can remember that he did get down, but the picture is still one of sandy, hilly terrain. But it was no longer the hard rock that one associated with the Rysett Ridge.
You mentioned the fighting at the top of the ridge against the Italians. Did they put up a good show there?
I'm not really competent to say. I mean, there were Germans that the Gurks took on, I think, in the hills there. There must have been Germans, Italians, Germans. I'm pretty certain that the Gurkhas, and it would make sense, because that is the commanding high ground, then you have the middle ground, and then you have the area where he probably expected the major thrust to come through, and where the ground is, tanks could move across it, whereas on the hills and left, of course, they couldn't. I am pretty certain that the Gurks were facing Germans, and I'm pretty certain that that Lal Bahadur Thapa's attack would be against the Germans. The Jebel Fat Nasser is what it was called, wasn't it? That's right, yes.
Do you know which Italian forces were still in the area? Were they still the Folgore division that you'd met earlier?
I can give you your answer. 164 and 90 light divisions were reported as holding Fat Nasser, the intervening whole rolling ground in Rumana. Italian formations from Pistoia, Spezia and Trieste divisions were interspersed under German command, and 21st Panzer was concentrated in close support behind. I'm glad to find that, because I could clearly think of the Germans on the left flank, although I'm pretty certain that it was Italian shells or mortar bombs that were coming over our head.
Did you notice whether they'd had strongly entrenched positions on that ridge?
Yes. They were. It depends what you mean by strongly entrenched. It was a strong defensive position. There was a fair length of reasonably deep anti-tank trench dug in front of a ditch dug in front of the position. There were pretty good sangers at the top of the hill and trenches. It wasn't a cement position. But it was naturally pretty strong anyway. I would imagine that towards the coastal plain there were probably a good deal of minefields and barbed wire, but I mean, the bit we were in was essentially a very easy defended mountain position.
Did you see any German prisoners of war after the action had been concluded?
Yes, but there weren't long files going home like we'd seen from some actions. In any case, we were on the left, and indeed that night the battle started to fade away from us. There were, I think indeed, if I remember right, in that particular thing, we'd had 100 casualties, and yes, total casualties were about 400 in that particular battle.
By we, do you mean the infantry?
The division.
Or
the division.
Yeah, but not your own particular.
No, our own particular. We'd only lost two or three, and one was the battery commander I've already told you about. It was not. But for me personally, it was not a major event at all, except that it was an extremely frightening thing to have to attack, and having got there, it was not pleasant until the battle faded away. But it was the Gurkhas on the left and the 50th and 51st Divisions on the right that I think clinched the day.
Do you remember what sort of targets you were firing at once you'd got into position to give support?
I'm not at all certain that I actually did any observed fire that day. Our guns fired a lot on pre-arranged chutes and a barrage. I don't have any picture in my mind of observing fire that day. Doesn't mean I didn't, but I would probably remember it if I did.
Do you remember what the view was like from the top of the ridge?
Again, no. I did look over late at night. You can see a long way, and you can see towards Gabies, couldn't you? I remember a few flashes in the plain below. But no, there was nothing observable, really. It was just a long, long view. I think I mentioned the fact that that night we switched my radio over and we got BBC, and there was this girl with a lovely warm voice that suggested a very rounded figure. I wish I could remember her name. It was a well-known name of those times. But no, the battle in the end, after spending some unpleasant hours, the battle faded away from us.
I think the next action you mentioned was at Jebel Ghazi.
Yes. Now, Jebel Ghazi was unpleasant. We had several battles here, if I remember right. Unfortunately, the 4th Indian thing doesn't have a picture of it. But Jebel Ghazi was, or Ghazi or Ghazi, I wonder how which ought to pronounce. I never thought until today, because I never done it verbally before. Here I see myself in a bigger tank, in a Matilda. Pretty certain it would be a Matilda. And I see the Jebel Ghazi on the left. I think I've mentioned before the fact that there were Germans with stick bombs, and indeed one chap I remember being left-handed. I think I've mentioned that from my observation tank. It was there that I fired the core artillery for the first time, and indeed in the Fourth Indian book there is a picture of the artillery communications which made that possible. Yes, there it is. And we had lots of pre-arranged targets, and we call fire down on just saying Chrysler 10 rounds fire, and it came down on Chrysler. There's a word that leaped out of the page, the eerie moan of the naval werfel. The naval werfel we met for the first time here. That was a nasty thing to hear coming at you, if there ever was one. But eventually we stood around on the left there, and we fought battles around the Jebel Ghazi. Eventually we moved across to the right of the field of battle.
On the coast?
On the coast, okay. In the olive trees. Very close under a place called Takruna. And that really was frightening. We were about to go into battle there, and we knew we were going to lose very heavily. I mean, I think they were planning something like 30% casualties. Because Takruna saw everything. I've actually been back. I went to Tunisia, to our company in Tunisia a few years ago, and I was able to get back as far as Takruna. And I've actually been up to the German OP and looked down on the olive fields, olive trees, where we were so-called hidden. And they must have been terribly short of ammunition or something, because otherwise they could have wiped us out at any moment of the day.
Do olive trees not provide good cover then?
Oh, there was some cover, yes. But I mean, Takruna stuck up like, not like a fairy castle. It was a jagged rock with a town on top, with a bit like Hangman's Hill